I'm looking forward to introductions, Tony, at your end, from you about who is in the room. And thank you so much, Wilma. And so this is the eighth class in the 2006 spring offering of Globalization Since 1492. And I'm looking forward to a good discussion tonight. We've got a couple of celebrated raconteurs, could I say, good pundits. Tony Seed is the editor and creator, more or less, of Shun Piking Magazine. There's the issue on Gaelic. He's created this dossier on Palestine, a very rich document, and I have them available here for $5 each. So Tony has worked for the Globe and Mail, and you were introduced to him about a month ago when he was speaking with Alexa McDonough. And recall that I mentioned that he ran against Alexa McDonough on behalf of the Communist Party of Canada. And of course, since the Communist Party of Canada, bracket Marxist-Leninist, the Communist Manifesto in 1848, which sort of captured much of the fervor of that time. There was major transformations taking place in Europe, where the old guard was giving way to the bourgeois, to the middle class. The Communist Manifesto was published that year, and of course it had those famous words, "Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains." So certainly Karl Marx had a vision of globalization. The picture of proletarian internationalism was very much a global response, an effort to make a global response to the global nature of finance, of high finance. And so the concept that nationalism was used as a way to oppress people, to divide people, that was very much part of Marx's way of interpreting the Industrial Revolution. So obviously, communism during the Cold War, this was the forbidden idea during the Cold War. Growing up and being socialized in North America, it was very hard to bring yourself to look at this objectively, because there was so much psychological warfare going on during the Cold War. So it was an interesting moment when the communist critic of the NDP were sitting side by side, and I was looking forward to that last half hour. In any case, thank you, Tony, for agreeing to come back tonight. As we've discussed it up until now, and I want to leave the maximum latitude for you to construct your presentation, and as we go into the discussion, to respond as you see fit. But as I understood it from our discussions over the week, you're going to focus on the creation of Palestine, on the creation of Israel, on Zionism, and we're going to connect this to a discussion of imperialism, colonialism, and we're going to connect it to a presentation in the second half from my good friend Mike Bruisedhead, who's in the front here. And Mike, I first met in Ottawa before I moved to Lethbridge. If you press the button in front of you, the camera will shift there. Yeah. Press it twice. No, the green button, Mike. Yeah, we'll just see if it... There we go. So, yeah. Mike has been on the chief and council. He's been a band counselor at the Blood Reserve. Tonight he's going to address and talk about his experience as a translator between Blackfoot and Cree elders who were in London, England at the time of the patriation of the Canadian Constitution. And the patriation of the Constitution speaks to the reality that all the constitutional instruments before 1981-82 are instruments of the British government, of the British Parliament, or in some cases simply unilateral declarations of the monarch. For instance, the Royal Proclamation of 1763, which has a great deal to do with Indian treaties, is simply a statement of the British imperial monarch. So the fear was, as Canada was getting control of its constitution, of its highest law, of its supreme law, as there was this final passing of constitutional powers to Canada as part of devolution of powers, Indian people were concerned that the promises, that the commitments made by the British imperial government would not be respected by the government of Canada as the provinces and the federal government took control of the process of constitutional amendment. So it seems to me this was a very interesting moment in terms of globalization. Nitsitapi, a delegation of local Aboriginal people going to one of the centers of power on the planet. So Mike was in between this council of elders. Apparently Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth was present, was part of the proceedings, hearing them on some kind of tape recording. So she was there. It was the House of Lords where this was taking place. So it was a kind of international delegation receiving an Aboriginal delegation from Canada, and Mike was translating between Blackfoot and English, ultimately for the Queen herself. So that's the episode we'll focus on, and I think we can see patterns in Indigenous peoples dealing with imperialism and colonialism. And when I say Indigenous peoples, I feel entitled to refer to the Palestinians as the Indigenous peoples of Palestine, the Indigenous peoples in this area. So that's the framework that we're going to try to develop. And the more interactive we can be, this isn't just feeding information. We can talk back, television that talks back. So I assume in Halifax that you're going to be there until 7 o'clock. Is that right, Tony? Do we know when it works?
It's up to you.
Well, last time it just cut out. I assume that's going to happen at 7 o'clock. It's not up to me. It's,
that was an accident. No, we can stay here as long as the discussion goes.
Okay, Tony, would you like to introduce the people in the room with you, or would you like to leave that till later?
Very briefly, I'm joined by two friends, David DeVoe on my right here. Is a graduate student of sociology at Dalhousie University, native of Cape Breton. Mohamed Kerbia is also a student at Dalhousie in commerce.
Computer science.
In computer science, sorry. I know Mohamed through his, he's one of the leading activists of the Palestine Solidarity Society, which is very active not only at Dalhousie University, but also at St. Mary's University. And in terms of the question tonight, he can also speak at it. And we may be joined later by some other members of the Palestine Solidarity Society, students, whose families originate from Palestine and can speak on a first-person basis as to what has unfolded both historically as well as in the contemporary period with regard to Israel and the issue of Zionism.
So take her away.
You just put the date on there.
Do you want me to begin?
Yep.
The date on there.
The summer before last, we held a very important symposium in Halifax that it was actually the first time I met Dr. Tony Hall. The Halifax International Symposium on Media and Disinformation. And it was to take up the problems of what is disinformation and how people are dealing with this problem. In other words, it's not an academic, it's not an intellectual problem. It's actually a practical problem of first-rate significance. The symposium was opened by Chief Reginald Maloney of Indian Brook First Nations. And he said a very important thing. On behalf of the Mi'kmaq First Nations, he welcomed all the delegates, and delegates came from South Asia, from America, and the United Kingdom. And he welcomed them to the Mi'kmaq territory. And he said, for us, the problem of disinformation begins in 1492. That is with the question of discovery. Who discovered the Americas? Right? And you mentioned the negotiations that were carried out with the Queen of England. She visited Canada in 1997 as part of the commemorations of the 500th anniversary of the landfall of Jean Caboto in Newfoundland or Cape Breton. I mean, Newfoundland and Cape Breton both compete as to, you know, who greeted him first, and as it turned out, who shot at him first. She said, Caboto's landfall, quote, represented the geographical and intellectual beginning of modern North America. Queen Elizabeth is saying this in the year 1997, just 8 years ago. That is, North America begins, in terms of its intellectual life, its cultural life,
which one?
500 years before, or now 508 years ago. That is, with the colonization of America by the Europeans. So this is what we call, it's not only a doctrine of, it's not only a racialist doctrine, it's specifically what we call Eurocentrism. And Eurocentrism is an outlook that begins with the rise of the slave trade. Before the slave trade, you had you did have slavery, like the Romans enslaved people. Even in the African nations, people were enslaved by different kingdoms and different tribes and so forth. But it's really with the rise of the slave trade that you have a peculiar outlook is created and developed and nurtured and spread and disseminated, which is that people are divided on the basis of skin color. People are divided on the basis of inferior and superior categories. And these categories then are used to characterize social and historical development according to race or according to culture. So you have the doctrine of Eurocentrism as a specific manifestation of what can also be called ethnocentrism, which is the belief in the inherent superiority of one's own group and culture, accompanied by a feeling of contempt for other groups and cultures. And secondly, a tendency to view alien groups or cultures in terms of one's own. So this worldview was then given in the last century, I'm sorry, in the 1800s, intellectual credibility by various social scientists who came forward to challenge the discoveries of Marx and Engels, that societies are characterized by their mode of production, their social and historical development. And one of the founders of anthropology the 1870s, 1880s, a man named Edward Tyler defined progress as, quote, the movement along a measured line from grade to grade of actual savagery, barbarism, and civilization. The savage state, in some measure, represents an early condition of mankind, out of which the higher culture has been gradually been developed or evolved. So thus we see that the Eurocentric outlook, as defined by the leading thinkers and scientists of Europe, looks down on all peoples of African, Arabic, Asian, American descent as subhuman people without history or without thought, who are destined for servitude, who are destined for enlightened tutelage. Before the European slave trade emerged, there was no such uniform or universal ideology which divided mankind on such a basis of race, you know, not only of race, but of superior and inferior social beings. So when we come to the question of the Middle East, the way we are raised in Canada to look at it is precisely through this prism. That is of people who have been enslaved either by the Turks through the Ottoman Empire or through an alien ideology called the Islamic religion. And all the problems of the Middle East these days are depicted in this prism, that is, in religious colors. And the events which are unfolding there are portrayed as one of ethnic violence, sectarian warfare, people fighting amongst themselves. But the West has come there to provide this enlightened tutelage, advanced forms of democracy. When the Americans invaded Iraq, Bush declared that one of the higher ideals of this occupation was to spread democracy through the Middle East. Okay? So this is one question I wanted to bring before your class in that students should consider, is this problem of Eurocentrism. That is it only European thought and European political institutions through which the different peoples and nations of the world can find a solution to their problems, right? As we know, many societies, whether in Africa or in the Middle East or in South America or in South Asia, had very high levels of civilization. And their accomplishments were not only in the intellectual and cultural level, but also technological. I visited a place in Sri Lanka where Canadian engineers had been sent on an aid project to build a system of waterways in an ancient Sinhalese city. And they said, precisely at this place, we should build the conduits to bring the water from this lower level to a higher level reservoir, from a lower level river to a higher level reservoir. So they started doing construction work. And in the construction work, they actually found from the 12th century that the engineers of that time had already built this water course, where the water moved uphill without the use of electric motors or any other system. Right? And I give this only as an example to say these societies had tremendous achievements. So the issue is, on what basis do people solve the problems? Do they solve the problems on the basis of their own efforts, on the basis of their own peoples, which includes their own thought tradition, their own cultural and historical traditions? Or, on the other hand, as the United States and Europe and their allies and puppets throughout the world dictate that they should be solved on the basis of European traditions. That is, democracy is characterized as not as a rule of the majority, but as a party system, for example. The parliamentary system is presented as democratic, as one of the most modern forms of political democracy. So when we look at the Middle East and the question of Israel and Palestine, we have to look back to the origin of the problem. And our belief is that the solution is the deed of the people there. It is not something that is going to be negotiated through some international peace process of powers from outside the region, such as the United States, Britain, Russia, and so forth. Okay. So basically, you have, as you know, the Palestinians are a distinct people with a history of several thousands of years. They're descendants of the original Canaanites, Philistines, and Canaanites. Whereas, on the other hand, the people who inhabit present-day Israel are not descendants of anybody in the Middle East. Okay, and I'll come back to that point later. Throughout the last couple thousands of years, you had a very high level of development in different levels in the Middle East. You had the building in the 600s, 688, I think, of the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It became, like Jerusalem became the religious center for the whole Middle East, along with Mecca. And it became also a very important thoroughfare for trade between rising European capitalism and colonialism and Africa, as well as the Middle East. Not the Middle East, I'm sorry, Asia, especially India and China. In 1845, the British developed a slogan. You know how it goes, a land without a people.
A land without a people, people. Land without people, people without a land.
Yeah. The first political Zionists are not actually Jewish. They're British lords, like Lord Shaftesbury. And they developed the slogan, people without a land, land without a people. And a movement has started to colonize Palestine from Europe. At the same time, a movement starts amongst the Palestinians of political organizing. At this time, Palestine is part of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire was based in Turkey. And the Ottoman Empire was based on the feudal mode of production. Unlike the rising European empires, the Austrian-Hungarian Empire, the German Empire, the French Empire, and the British Empire. And one of the characteristics of the Ottoman Empire was relative autonomy in different regions. So you had the development of a movement for greater political autonomy and self-rule in Palestine that actually begins in the 1840s. And this exists in the form of different societies, like literary societies, religious societies, and political societies. But because of the feudal rule, these societies actually had to organize on a secret basis. Throughout this next 50 years, that is to the turn of the century, you have the development in various forms of this movement to the extent that around the turn of the century, you actually have Palestinians are being elected as deputies to the parliament in Ankara, Turkey, the parliament of the Ottomans. At the same time, you have the building of the Suez Canal, where you have both the French and the English are involved in, especially this family called Rothschilds, which also had a branch in both France and England. And the first financiers of Zionist colonies in Palestine are the Rothschilds, the same family that is involved in financing the Suez Canal. That is the same interests that are involved in modernizing trade routes at very strategic junctures, such as the Suez, to facilitate the export of the manufacturers of Europe, the export of capital, the import of natural resources from the areas which are being colonized both in Africa and in South Asia. At the same time, there was another project being developed, that is of a railway that would link the Europe through the Balkans, through the Middle East, down to Rhodesia is being formed, South Africa is being formed. So in other words, Palestine is at a very strategic juncture for both the imperial powers of Europe as well as the colonized peoples of Africa and Middle East and South Asia. The Palestine movement is also part of a broader movement of the Arabic peoples, and this is called the Pan-Arab movement, or the movement of the great of Pan-Arab nationalism, but it's called the Umma, right? The awakening of the Arabic peoples. So they actually organized congresses, both secret and open. Secret in the sense that when they're held in either Palestine, Syria, Lebanon, or Egypt, or open if the congresses are held in Europe. You also have the development of intellectual and cultural life. You have the publishing of Palestinian newspapers. You have the organization of women. By the way, today is International Women's Day. So you have a whole awakening, right? And the awakening is in terms of both the struggle against the Ottoman Empire, but it also takes into account the increasing colonization of people of Jewish faith. Now, I want to stress right at this point, historically, there is no enmity of, there are no examples of enmity of amongst peoples on a religious basis in Palestine or generally speaking in the Middle East. And I'd like to give a quotation from Chaim Weizmann, who was head of the World Zionist Movement. He acknowledged that the Islamic society of that time did not victimize the Jew. Quote, I would not like to do any injustice. The Muslim world has treated the Jews with considerable tolerance. The Ottoman Empire, of which the Arabs were a large part, received the Jews with open arms when they were driven out of Spain and Europe, and the Jews should never forget that. Many examples can be cited which show that the Palestinians, who are comprised mainly of Muslims and Christians, and a minority of Jews, were brothers in terms of nationality, in terms of language, and in terms of interest. Their interest was the land and their society, and developing the land and developing their society. And basically, they lived in peace. So when the first basically colonies of those of Jewish faith were organized, they were viewed as immigrants who came for religious reasons. And they had high respect for, you know, people of religion. They did not, in the beginning, see that this was actually the thin edge of the wedge, so to speak. And they did not see the motives of the British in terms of covertly backing this. So then, to be very brief, you have a settlement that takes place of Palestine from Europe that goes through several distinct phases. So one phase is from the 1840s up to the 1890s. So this phase is characterized by the establishment of individual colonies which are subsidized by rich families of Europe with the support of the different courts of Europe. The next phase goes from the 1890s up until the First World War. The next phase goes from the First World War, 1921, up until 1948, period. And then we can go from 1948, period, to the present time. Each of these historical phases have definite questions. What does this mean? Or definite features. In the 1890s, to the time of the First World War, what takes place is in Europe, a political movement called Zionism is organized. The leader of this movement is Theodor Herzl. And this movement is based on different congresses which are held mainly in Switzerland in the 1890s. Zionism at this time is not accepted by the world Jewish, you know, people of Jewish faith. In fact, many Jewish congresses and assemblies spoke out against Zionism because Zionism said that the solution to our problems lies in emigrating to the Promised Land and creating our own state. So for this reason, it was also very useful to the European powers who, within their own countries, were pursuing a policy of anti-Semitism to divide the working people. This is to the extent that in Russia, which was under the Tsar, pogroms were actually organized called the Black Hundreds, where thousands, tens of thousands of people are organized, are slaughtered on a racial basis, where people of, where Jews are forced to live outside the city in what is called beyond the pale. Okay? Zionism, as a political doctrine, rests on the anti-Semitism that was followed with in Europe. Because without anti-Semitism, Zionism would not have troops. It would not draw people. So it represented a movement not to solve your problems in your own country, not to solve your problems with the rest of the working people, but to escape. And for this reason, as I said, it was supported by the different European governments. There is a very interesting episode that took place in 1903-1904 period, just to show the real character of Zionism. At this time, Theodor Herzl was lobbying the different courts of Europe to try and find a patron. Now, Herzl did not care where the promised land lay, even though they are using these religious prophecies about Jerusalem and Israel and so forth. At one time, he was actually negotiating with the British Colonial Office to be given Uganda. At another time, the promised land was to be in Argentina. Okay, so their whole approach was pragmatic, any means to the end. So these religious prophecies are just a means of hoodwinking their own people. That is, colonizing and exploiting their own people and getting them to throw their lot in with the Zionists. And this was to the extent that Herzl went to St. Petersburg, where he had a meeting with the Tsarist government. At that time, Tsarist Russia was an ally of the Ottoman Empire. And they wanted the Tsarist government to use their influence with the Ottoman Empire to loosen the land restrictions on ownership, so that more Jewish colonization of Palestine could be facilitated. So he meets with the interior minister of Tsarist government, who is a man named Von Pelev. Who is Von Pelev? He was the same interior minister who organized the Black Hundreds, the pogroms of the Jewish people. These are very notorious, infamous pogroms. This is the Holocaust of Tsarist Russia, so to speak. So he sits down with him, and he asks Herzl, he says, well, if we do this with our, you know, with the Ottomans, what are you going to do for us? And he says, well, I don't know. What would you have us do? So this time, Tsarist Russia is in the midst of its own revolutionary upheaval, which actually culminates in the first revolution of 1905. The first social revolution in Tsarist Russia. And in this, you have the Bolsheviks as a new political force are organizing the working masses of Tsarist Russia, not only politically, but also in terms of factories. They're organizing unions and so forth. And the police came up with a tactic of organizing alternative unions, which they themselves would organize, and I call this police socialism. That is, agents of the police would go into the factories, and they would organize the unorganized workers into unions, but they would make sure that they were apolitical, and in this way curb the spread of the Bolshevik influence, this, you know, social revolution. So the deal with Herzl and the Tsarist government was that the Zionists, who had a considerable press within Russia, the Jewish press, they would speak against the Bolsheviks, and they would organize against the Bolsheviks, and they would support these apolitical unions called police socialism, or what was called at the time Zubatov socialism. Zubatov was the police commissioner of Russia. I mentioned this to show the real role that Zionists played in Europe. In other words, they themselves were counter-revolutionaries. They were traitors of the people of Russia, the people of Poland, and so on and so forth. It's only at the time of the First World War that any imperial power really takes up the Zionist project in serious. And that power is Britain. In 1917, the British Army under General Allenby captured Jerusalem. And you know the British might makes right. There were two important developments that took place, which had taken place. On the one hand, as anybody who has seen the film Lawrence of Arabia would know, there was an agreement between the British and the leaders, some of the leaders amongst the Arabs, such as Fazal. And this is in the correspondence. It's actually written down in the correspondence, and it's called the McMahon Faisal correspondence, where they promised the Arab people's independence after the end of the First World War, so long as they supported them and opposed the Ottoman Empire and the Germans during the First World War. At the same time, Britain and France had a secret agreement, and this is called the Sykes-Picot Agreement. And in this secret agreement, that is secret in the sense this is negotiated behind the backs of the Arabs who have, you know, signed this agreement, they divide up the Middle East between themselves, and they provide that England, which at that time controlled Egypt and the Suez Canal, would take over Palestine and Iraq from the Ottoman Empire, and the French would get Lebanon and Syria. So here you have the whole European Eurocentrism, in the sense that deals are made in the European capitals to divide up whole regions of the world. So in 1917, the Arab army, you know, the Arab, because of the role of the heroic role of the Arab armies under Faisal and so forth, the Ottomans are driven out of the Middle East. Already the Greek people in 1912 had risen up in revolt. So the Ottomans had been driven out of the Balkans. The Albanians rose up in revolt in 1912 as well, and also the Bulgarians, okay? So this whole area is a tinderbox of social ferment, of rising national independence struggles. And as I said before, you have a rising national movement amongst the Palestinians. At the same time, Allenby controls Jerusalem. So then you have the Versailles Conference after the war. Now, the very other important thing that takes place is what is called the Balfour Declaration. And this is also issued in 1917. And I'd just like to quote from that. The Balfour Declaration was issued in November 2, and Lord Balfour was the British Foreign Secretary. So he actually outlines a letter, in a letter to Lord Rothschild, of all people, what British policy is for Palestine. Quote, His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, a national home for the Jewish people, not a state, a national home, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Balfour later supplies the rationale, because he's actually contradicted now the written promises which were specifically given to Prince Faisal through the McMahon correspondence. And Balfour stated, in Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country. The four great powers have taken up the Zionist cause, and Zionism, be it just or false, good or bad, is rooted in longstanding traditions, in present needs, and in future hopes that are far more important than the desires or the frustrations of the 700,000 Arabs who live on this ancient land today. So there's no even pretense to be a democratic consultation. So this whole area, which is does not belong to Britain in the first place, is not British in the first place, is promised through a letter given by British cabinet to one of the leading Zionists, that is Lord Rothschild. Okay? This maneuver was to the extent that even the Jewish, there was one Jewish member of the British cabinet at that time, Lord Montague. And he was colonial secretary. He was actually sent to India to be out of the way at the time that the Balfour Declaration was issued. Okay? Montague himself was opposed to this because he said that the establishment of this new national home will not assist the Jewish people in Britain to solve the problems of anti-Semitism and social progress. But it will, for various reasons, it will facilitate the growth of anti-Semitism. Now, in the Versailles Agreement, this declaration is consummated, and then in 1921, a colonial mandate begins, where Britain has Palestine as a mandate, France has Lebanon as a mandate, but in Palestine the process of Zionist settlement is accelerated.
Tony, can you hear me? We're approaching the first hour here, and sure. I think we've got a very clear picture up until 1917. And I know we're going to want to get into, you know, 47, 48.
And the present time.
It occurred to me that trying to facilitate or promote the idea of a bit of exchange, that perhaps we could take this history or this part of the lecture up until this point with the consciousness that you'll be going back into the historical narrative. But I thought as we're discussing the role of Britain, the Balfour Declaration, the concept of a homeland for the Jewish people, a national homeland, and of course it grates on the Palestinian people to this day that the Balfour Declaration doesn't use the word Palestinian. It doesn't dignify that identity with even the use of the word. The word is the non-Jewish population. So I was with your